Welcome to the Queer at Queen's podcast with Hilary McCullum. This podcast was funded and supported by the Seamus Heaney Centre at Queen's University Belfast. It was produced and edited by Susie Bloom and recorded by Georgios Varoutsos. Today we have Dawn Watson in conversation with our host Hilary. Please enjoy.
My name's Hilary McCullum and I'm the current publishing fellow at the Seamus Heaney Centre. And I'm delighted to be talking today to Dawn Watson as part of our Queer at Queen's podcast series. Dawn Watson is a writer from Belfast. Her poetry pamphlet, The Stack of Owls Is Getting Higher, was published in 2019 by the Emma Press. Her work has been broadcast on BBC Radio 4 and has appeared in literary journals including Granta, The Manchester Review, The Moth and The Stinging Fly. Dawn was awarded second place in the Funeral Services NI National Poetry Competition in 2016. She was a finalist in the 2020 Michael McLaverty Short Story Awards. She was selected as one of the 2018 Poetry Ireland Introduction Series Poets and won the 2018 Doolan Writers Poetry Award. Her debut collection, We Play Here, is forthcoming with Granta Books in spring 2023. So thanks very much for agreeing to be part of the podcast. I'm really looking forward to talking to you. I wondered if we might start with your work that was in Granta, The Starlings of Dunmore Died on the 11th of July, which for those who are interested is in issue 158 of Granta magazine, which is called In the Family. Yeah, so maybe you just want to tell us about that poem and how it came about.
It's part of the book then that's forthcoming with Granta in April, which is a book of four poem sequences. And they're all voiced from the point of view of 12-year-old girls that grew up in North Belfast in the 80s. And specifically in the area that I grew up in, which was sort of Skegganeil Avenue, Ashfield Gardens, Glandore Parade, and the environment around there. So that one specifically... Yeah, I mean, it was written from the point of view of a child who is, they are living in a sort of situation where their home life would be particularly turbulent. So they spend a lot of their time out in spend all day in a park, walking around the streets. And I guess finding that kind of imaginative space that allows you to survive that kind of childhood environment, you know, so that ultimately... The four girls come together in the final story and they look for the father of one of the girls who's gone missing. It's implied that there's sort of paramilitary involvement set, you know, during the Troubles. But before that, yeah, we meet each of them individually. So the Starlings of Dunmore, ultimately this girl comes across a large murmuration of birds in the park and she kind of believes that she has somehow brought them into being or sort of invoked them into life. So she's disturbed to find that when she does return home, they follow her home and fall out of the sky. So the ground is completely littered with birds. It's a phenomenon that you see, you know, with these birds, you know, around the UK sort of quite frequently and around the world. And it's a bit of a mystery, I think, as to why it happens. There's a lot of theories, but yeah, I mean, that's fundamentally the story.
I didn't know that. So actually, murmurations, they can suddenly just all of them die.
Yeah. If you Google this, you'll see it happens all the time where suddenly it's as if they missed their cue and they all at once sort of landed in the ground. There's theories about it, which I can't remember at this moment, but it's as though something's gone wrong with their navigation system or they've kind of, something's gone awry and they're suddenly hundreds of birds found all over the road, all over a field and fascinating, yeah.
And I guess that's what's happening in her life. Her life's kind of gone a bit awry.
I think you see it. I mean, these poem sequences are very short excerpts. So maybe there would be about 20 excerpts in each poem sequence. And I think what you find with that particular sequence is a kind of a feeling that mimics the movement of the birds. It kind of swirls and sort of you get to the heart of the story, of the narrative that's happening, which is... a fight between her mom and dad, which is super violent. They both, the mom and the daughter, escape from the house. And it's very much that point of like how everything has fallen down, I guess, in a way that's like the birds. But ultimately, I think it doesn't stop there and how she deals with it when she finds the birds and what, you know, her own sort of way of burying them and paying tribute to them. And the sense, I think, of just lots of little things coming together to form one big thing, and that sense of cohesion and togetherness that I think when little things that have no power come together into kind of a bigger force. There's another poem sequence in the book where that the same thing happens with a little stickleback fish, and it's a kind of huge shoal of them sort of flowing behind the girl. They all end up in the Grove Park looking across at the docks, which is a kind of a focal point for all the four sequences in the book. Obviously the docks representing, you know, that kind of working class heritage, particularly, you know, from that kind of Protestant end of things in Belfast.
The sequence that's in the Granter magazine is the full title is The Starlings of Dunmore Died on the 11th of July. And obviously the 11th of July isn't a kind of neutral date.
Yeah.
In the north of Ireland. So why did you choose for it to be on the 11th of July?
I wrote this book actually as part of my PhD at Queen's, when alongside of it, I was looking at the poem stories of Elizabeth Bishop. And a lot of what she would, you know, her poem stories would have been memoir based. They would have been focused on like a young girl who witnesses her mom being taken to an asylum when she's 5 years old, and the trauma of that unfolds. And there's an elemental feeling to these stories, you know, where we see water, we fire, earth. I wanted that to be the case in We Play Here, and I very much saw the starling sequences, you know, the air, but also the fire. And what's left behind. But it is interesting how that ended up being about the 12th. And it also linked in with the Dunmore Greyhound Stadium, which is something that I did used to hear at night in when I was going to bed. You hear the traps release and sort of the adults cheering and that kind of sense of division. But it's a good question. I don't know if I would completely even know how to answer if it was intentional or not. But I think just in writing a book that the Troubles were so important to, but yet I didn't want to speak about directly, but I wanted them to inform things on a background level and how this kind of trauma and inherited trauma and how this just informs children's lives in that generation. And especially, I think, in Protestant, those kind of areas which weren't, you know, as directly, I feel like, associated with the Troubles as you might when you talk about West Belfast, and it's a different narrative. And I feel that you can almost grow up feeling like, do I have the right to talk about the Troubles? You know, when I didn't see meat wagons every single day coming up my street and I had a different experience of it, where certainly you saw soldiers, you saw these things, but there was a sort of a remove. But I guess I wanted to keep that focus central and that disruption central to the lives of the children.
And this poem sequence is part, as you were saying, so it's part of a wider collection called We Play Here, which will be published next year. So can you just tell us about why you've written We Play Here?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I do mention in the book, which is true, one of the speakers in the book talks about their favourite film being Stand By Me, which is a 1980s film by Rob Reiner about four boys around the same age, just on that cusp of adulthood, sort of before the trappings, I think, of adolescence and puberty kind of kick in, and you're kind of free to almost sort of manifest in a way which is, I think, not so heavily gendered. But you always see in these kind of stories and these kind of films, and I do love these coming of age sorts of films, but they're generally boys, I think, that you see as being the heroes. And I simply wanted to write a book that had girls and working class girls as the heroes and to be the heroes. And that's how I came to write We Play Here. Initially, I started the set in America, until, you know, my supervisor, actually Leontia Flynn, suggested that, what if I located it in Belfast? And I had never even thought of writing about Belfast, and funnily enough, and sometimes it takes for someone else to point something out to you. But yeah, that was my intention behind it. And yeah, I've realised sort of through that process, I think, how important it is to bring that kind of lived experience to life. And I don't see it written anywhere so much. I think women's stories generally are undertold, but particularly children who are so neglected and so unempowered, and like their lives could almost just, I mean, coming out of a working class background and even going to university is a massive achievement. It's not something that's, you know, signposted to you, I think, is something when you come from a background that maybe is working class or poverty and, you know, all of that. I think that it's almost so unlikely that you might even realize that you can do these things. And I think to be in a position where I could actually open a window from 1988 to now and have those voices come through, that was my intention.
class, I think, comes through not only in that work, but in some of your other work. So, yeah, can you maybe talk a little bit about why talking about writing about class is important to you?
I think it's probably just, you know, in a very innate way, it's just my creative landscape seems to belong in that kind of working class landscape, but that background. I mean, I did obviously grow up in a single parent family in working class area of North Belfast. And then I moved to East Belfast in my teens and continued to live in sort of housing estates and whatnot. And it's just incredible to me now, you know, I'm 44. I've just reached the end of a 10-year education process where I went to university in my 30s. I hadn't gone before that. I just went straight into journalism in my 20s. And I think to have arrived now to finish the PhD and to, you know, have written this book. And I guess I'm not intentionally going out there and saying, right, I'm going to talk about working class. I'm going to talk about the importance of it. But it is so important. And I think I'm just more and more increasingly aware when I look back and I see what I've written before. And it's just this retrospective awareness. And I see how important it is to me. Mm-hmm. And I think at this point going forward, I think, right, well, how can I more intentionally talk about that? And it's probably something that I will look at more intentionally in the future.
Your work also touches on issues around mental health and grief. So examples come from like report from a psychiatric hospital in 1969 and Sonny's Bench and compulsions in children during grief. So those were some of the ones, some of your work that I've read that touches on those issues. Why is that an issue that you've also wanted to explore?
I think it's a complex question for me. Mental health, I think about it, you know, and there's certainly, you know, on a personal level within my family, I have seen that, you know, at first hand. I have seen certain aspects of mental health that have been poorer. But then again, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that it would inform you creatively. You know, in the same way, I have three siblings and I'm not massively interested in writing stories about siblings. Mm. But it's fascinating to me to look back, like, I mean, over, you know, things like The Run, which was set in a psychiatric facility. And I did used to run around the grounds of Purdiesburn, as it was known, and Knockbracken, as it's called now. My partner had an allotment plot that was up in that area, so I would tend to leave her and go on a run. And I'm very, very preoccupied with it. And I've spoken about it before, and it's like, what is it I'm trying to get to? What is it I'm getting at? Similarly with the report from a psychiatric hospital in 1969, you know, I'd watched this documentary called E. Giordana Diaboli, and it was directed by, you should look it up, it's 26 minutes long, directed by Sergio Savoli, where he interviews a journalist. He interviews a psychiatrist called Basaglia, who made huge changes to like the landscape of mental health institutions in Italy. He was responsible for, I think, overturning this kind of sense of like, once you're locked up, you're locked away. And he wanted to kind of let, you know, that it shouldn't be a life sentence with mental health issues. But in this documentary, you know, that you see interviews with people who are committed in this Gorizia asylum. And one of them was the lady I wrote about in the poem. And she was just beautiful. You know, she's a woman and she seemed to be in her 60s or 70s. And the things that she was saying, you know, I find myself really profoundly moved. I wish I'd brought the poem with me, actually, I'd intended to. But it was also, again, she commented on, the rich are not mad, the poor are mad. You know, she just spoke about like how she copes with being there. It's just like sing, you know, if you're able to. And I think I just see mental health as something obviously innately frightening to me. And I think the thought of, I've mentioned it in poems before. I think in the stack of vials is getting higher. I mention how I'm terrified in case I go insane and hurt someone, I think is a line from one of the poems called Hello, I'm Alive. It's obviously something that I just find on some really innate level very scary. The thought of just how fragile I think we are. And I think we term it as mental health at the minute, but there's just so much that's unknown that within how our brains work as humans.
Going back to what you were saying about, you know, the rich aren't mad, it's the poor that get considered mad. And that term eccentric, you don't really get the word eccentric is a very classed word, and you have to have a certain amount of money to be eccentric.
Yeah, exactly.
Working class people aren't eccentric; they're crazy.
Yeah, absolutely, it just comes back again. I think to class, and Didier Erebon writes about it just really articulately in Returning to Reims, and I think particularly people from a working class background and how you come into your adulthood and you find yourself inevitably moving towards a more middle class sort of situation where maybe you have more money available to you, or you're moving in sort of middle class educated circles, and how you can end up in a place where you don't really feel like you belong in either. And that can be a real grief. And he writes about it quite interestingly, which is also that there's no way to sort of help you cope with that, in the way that almost like when you come out as being gay, there's more of a sense socially that you're welcomed into coming out, that that's a good thing. That, I mean, with in liberal circles, certainly anyway, that's something that you're almost sort of, you know, helped with in some way. But when you're actually trying to come out and say, oh, you know what, I grew up without the money for food most days, you know, it's like, well, you're on your own a wee bit more, because I don't think we have the mechanisms to talk about that in a way that's supportive. And I think there's a lot of shame underpinning working class people's existence and movement through publishing circles and through academic circles.
Yeah, and a kind of an assumption that, of course, you'd much rather be middle class, and everybody would much rather be middle class, assumption that everybody else would want to be middle class if they got the chance.
I think so. And I think you tend to sort of ape your own sort of background a little bit more, like with people who also understand. You know, I have some friends who grew up around the Shore Road area, and we would really, when we meet up for coffee, we'd end up going for chips and beans or something. That's just really like, you know, we're just going to go back to your roots kind of a feeling about it. But certainly, yeah, there's this idea that you've got to maybe minimize your accent. You've got to make it a little bit more acceptable. That's not something I've consciously done. It's something that I think has been more like drilled into me growing up. I wasn't really allowed to speak in a super broad accent. I do think there's a lot of things that you carry with you. There's a lot of markers of class that you carry with you. And I find I would be quite quick sometimes to try to demonstrate efficiency, or like if we've had a meeting or a coffee thing, I would maybe clear up the cups, or I would show my worth in some kind of way that isn't just being.
Yeah.
And that's interesting to think about.
And probably quite complicated in the context of university. I mean, I guess I'm thinking about some of my own experience in that. I went to university in the days where you still could get a grant. When I was in my first year, I went to Bristol, and I knew one other person on a full grant. One person.
Yeah.
About, I think, half of the people that were on my floor in the halls, and I only lasted in the halls for a term because I couldn't stand it. I was so alienated.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were, half of them had gone to private school. And it's just, yeah, it is very, that kind of exclusion, I think, that still can happen around universities of working class people.
I think you do. I think you carry it from high school. I think there was one of my friends, we both got free school meals. There's just two of us. And as soon as the bell went, we would light down the corridor as fast as we could to get to the top of the queue. Like one time we dragged a desk into the corridor to block everyone off so we could get there in time to get the chips. But everybody else would have had packed lunches. And there was even something like sort of social, there was a social statement in bringing a packed lunch, you know, that you were somehow, you could afford to bring a packed lunch, you know. I certainly wouldn't have gone on any school trips or any ski trips or any of that. And in a way you just kind of, yeah, you just maybe, you know, you sort of maybe have a mindset of that's not for me, you know. You can spend a lot of time in your life. I think it's worth spending time adjusting and noticing and just noticing it, I think.
I guess, so there's also around poetry, been seen maybe that poetry is a bit of a middle class thing.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously not exclusively, so there are some fantastic working class poets, but, you know, I think it probably would be seen as a kind of middle class thing. So, yeah, how did that affect you coming to poetry and becoming a poet?
I had always thought that I would be a novelist. And I think when I went to university, I really had an attitude of like being on fire with just wanting to be excellent at everything and really make the most of my time. I didn't sort of relax for a second. And when I look back now, you know, that's, I could have relaxed a bit more, but I intended to write a novel. And maybe in some ways, you know, confronting those kind of inner prejudices, maybe a novel seems like the more acceptable face of writing or something, and more sort of legitimate. And maybe that's even borne out in the fact that, you know, I think it makes probably more money to write a best-selling novel than it does to write a best-selling collection of poetry. But for me, poetry was really actually about discovering a whole different level of how to communicate and how to put, when I kind of thought about putting narrative together with the lyric form, there's a sort of a tension in that. And I found that there was just a magic or a power in it. And I was just super interested in exploring it. And thankfully I let that guide me rather than any kind of worries about what that would look like or anything else. I'm not troubled by that in that sense, that I'm, I think, far enough removed from maybe my own childhood not to be super worried about what anyone might think of it. But I'm just, am aware that even when I'm in the dentist and they're like, well, how's your day? And you're like, well, I was just writing a poem. I suppose that doesn't seem acceptable to say. It doesn't seem acceptable. And I feel like I have to say something else. And I think I still even now would struggle with that on a certain level. And doing a PhD, I feel like I can relax a bit more if I've maybe done something around the house before I let myself write a poem, you know.
So because we've got there anyway, what is your writing process? Do you have any writing habits? Where do you write and what do you write on and those kind of things?
I tend to write in the mornings. If I wrote at night, it would be awful. It would be emotional and it would be dense. I find if I write at nighttime, it's really for your own private reading. It's not writing during the morning. I have the most clarity. Routine is a big part of my day. You know, I get up and I'm either doing a school run, I'm feeding the cats, and I'll work until sort of maybe early afternoon, and I'll go to the gym. And sort of beyond that, I'm not expecting too much of myself from writing. But in and amongst that, you know, I'm just constantly writing notes. The things that sort of inspire me tend to be very incongruous things, you know, things that items I've seen, or it's a whole other conversation. But yeah, I mean, I'm constantly making notes, and I think incorporating those into things. But I think I'm just quite organized and on a general level. I plan for what I'm doing, and I plan for my days and my weeks, and I have goals.
When you start writing a poem, would you start writing it as prose, or does it be poetry immediately? How does it come out?
Yeah, because I'm interested in the short story as a form, but poems are different, you know, they are a different thing. It just depends, you know, it depends. When I'm sitting down to write something, I know if it's going to be a story, and I know if it's going to be a poem, and I do approach them differently. What I used to find is when I sat down to write a poem, I just found it very unnatural. And my learning curve during my master's in poetry at Queen's was actually trying to write a poem that contained a sense of narrative, because they do need to have that. They do need to move from beginning to end. I didn't necessarily find that easy when I sat down to write a poem. I found that writing in a lineated form interrupted the flow of wherever it is that prose comes from within us. And there's been some great critics, like there's a New Yorker critic, Dan Chiasson, who's written about how prose sort of comes out of us in a more fluid way. And it's good for writing about timelines or linear stories. If you want to write about a particular event in your life, writing about it, first of all, in prose is a good idea, I think. You know, it gives you a sense of this happened and then this and then this. So sometimes I have written in prose and then I have adapted it into poetry. And that's something I am doing at the minute. I've written them in short, almost sort of prosaic style things, and then I'm sort of changing them. But also, you know, I've just written where I'm writing directly into poetry, and sometimes it just comes out that way. But whatever way it is, I approach it with a certain deliberateness.
And do you write longhand or do you write straight into the computer?
No, straight into the computer. I find that appeals to my sort of sense of order. For me, rhythm is a major part of anything that I write. And when I feel a sense of rhythm, the book that's coming out in April, we play here, sort of each of the lines would have a approximate sort of 5-beat. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. When I see that on a screen, I think it's easier, you know, to see how that looks in terms of the line length as well.
Mm. And do you save drafts, or do you just write over the top of the draft if you're redrafting?
I'm pretty bad for just writing over the top of things, and I know I should save drafts, but it feels untidy to me to have too many drafts. So, yeah, I do tend to write over things. Although now I have gotten into more of a habit. If I'm going to write a draft of it, I'll move the thing down the page and just write it again at the top. So I'm learning not to do that. All or nothing.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about Elizabeth Bishop's One Art and how you see the progress of it because you see the earlier draft.
I know, that's it. There's value in it. And I think having studied that, you know, I would be horrified to think of anybody were able to look at, you know, the early drafts of anything I've written. I do tend to write in a way that's quite edited and quite compressed, straight out of the bat. Yeah, I think I just made up a mixed metaphor there, straight out of the bat. Yeah. Gotten distracted now. What were you saying?
You mentioned the run earlier, and it's one of a number of your poems that touch on lesbian, or if you want, queer experience, whichever you'd rather. Do you think of yourself as a lesbian poet? Do you think you have to write poems about lesbian experience to be a lesbian poet?
No, I have to say no. I don't really think of myself as being like lesbian as a qualifier for anything, you know, and I never have, to be honest. And I think in my own particular experience has been, you know, that it didn't occur to me that I was even gay until I was 24. And I think it can be common enough for when you grow up in a way where you've sort of dissociated from certain aspects of your life. And I think for me, my sexuality was something that I just didn't even think about. And then I fell in love when I was 24. And that was the start of it all. I just always have had this feeling of like, I don't expect to be treated any differently. I don't expect to be, I'd hate to be thought of as just being as an LGBT poet in a way, because there's lots of issues. There's lots of things that are important to me to write about. And I don't know, you know, I don't know as I go along, I don't know if that's just me not even letting myself connect so much to how important it is, because obviously it's important. I'm gay, my wife's gay, my brothers and sisters are gay, their partners are gay. You know, I live in a world of gay, and I've always felt very supported in that, I think, by the people around me. And even by my journey through the Seamus Heaney Centre, I think I've always felt very supported. It's never felt like a difference or like something incongruous, I suppose. But I do think it's so important to, when I look around and I see LGBT writers and people speaking about that experience, and queer writers. And I think of the Lifeboats anthology recently, Queering the Green, edited by Paul Maddern. And I had some poems in it, had 7 poems in it. But again, you know, I find myself kind of thinking, where do I fit in this? You know, is the word queer even a word that I've never really used the word queer to describe myself. And it's something that I'm more comfortable with now in my 40s. And I can see why, yes, that word, it does apply to me. But I've never really felt that I fit into the LGBT world in Belfast. Mm. I've never really felt part of that community. But, you know, what is important to me, I think, is writing that othered experience, that experience of growing up feeling on the periphery. And that continuing through your 20s and your 30s and your 40s. And there is that. It's super important to me. And it was important to me in the pamphlet, The Stack of Oils. And it's important in everything I write to look at that sort of the incongruity of vulnerability sitting alongside harshness or things that just feel out of place. I'm drawn to writing about that othered experience. But
it's interesting. In Queer in the Green, I was talking to Paul about this. You know, he wanted each poet to have quite a number of poems. And I would say probably at least half of the ones that I've read, maybe probably more actually, of the ones that I've read so far, aren't explicitly anything to do with queer, LGBT, anything. They're just poets writing poems. And I like that. It's kind of creating a bit more freedom, that it's not the only thing that you have to talk about. I was at an event in Derry on Friday night, and you don't have people interviewed about being a straight poet. What's your experience as a straight poet? So I think some of what you've said resonates with what other people that I've been talking to have said.
I think so. I think even just I'm reluctant to be part of a female anthology. You know, just these kind of things that narrow you in some kind of a way so you can be consumed easier. I'm interested in talking about being gay, but I don't know that I'm interested in being recognised as a gay writer.
Yeah. You've had 2 poems filmed for the Adrian Brinkerhoff Poetry Foundation, Peach Season, and This Is Just to Say, The Gays Will Steal Your Fruit. So I was interested to know how did it come about that those 2 poems were recorded, and what was it like having them filmed?
I was really surprised. I was contacted by Poetry Ireland, and they asked me would I be interested in taking part, and they submitted, I think, a selection of my poems to the Adrian Brinkerhoff Foundation in New York, and Amanda Glassman got back to me, and she asked could they use these 2 poems, Peach Season and This Is Just to Say The Gays Will Steal Your Fruit, which is, you know, sort of a riff on William Carlos Williams' poem This Is Just to Say. It was during lockdown, I think, is the thing too, and everyone had let themselves go, and I been eating cereal every day, and I was like, oh my god, I'm going to be filmed walking around Belfast, at least the stone heavier. But you know, it was a great experience. You know, Matthew was fantastic. You know, I think we were in Belfast for 7 hours, and we just walked around, him filming me, and it was very much like you had to walk along, and he was like, don't just walk along, you have to think the poem, you have to say it in your mind, you've got to like believe that, you know, you've got to live it. So he was, I think, trying to really film more than just you. He was trying to really bring out the feeling of it. And it's interesting to see then what, you know, how it turned out in the end, and the music that was applied to it, and the way it was cut together. And I was really pleased with both of them. I think they're great. I think they're great pieces. It's interesting to see yourself through the lens of someone else and what they think represents you, you know. And I loved it. Yeah, it was good.
Like, I do find some of your imagery a bit unsettling. You know, some of your work's quite surreal. And why does that appeal to you?
Well, I think my whole pamphlet, The Stack of Owls Is Getting Higher, was quite surreal, but much of that was written during my master's, my poetry master's at Queen's. I was supervised by Stephen Sexton, who himself wouldn't be, I think, probably a stranger to the surreal. And there was just this feeling of trying to push myself to explore what you could achieve through language that invoked the feeling that I was trying to achieve, which was a feeling of, in Peach Season, as an example, you know, where the poet, the speaker sort of disappears, leaves her wife and son and disappears to the woods and never comes back. And what sort of crazy language kind of invokes that? And it was exploring that for me while trying to maintain the balance of also making sense so that someone could read it. And although it's surprising language and it's a little bit shocking at times, you still kind of know what's being communicated and why maybe those words have been chosen, because it still means something and it still has a cohesiveness. So it was kind of a very experimental time, I think, for me then. Some of it I've kept and some of it probably discarded. I think the importance of a poem is ultimately to surprise you as a poet as much as the person reading it.
I think definitely you managed to do that. What are you going to read?
Okay, this is Peach Season. She vanished at twilight across the field, slipping to the woods after clearing the leaves off the porch, leaving a note for her wife and son and dismantling all the windows. They had given her a basket and she filled it with peaches. Hours passed and she lost herself in peach trees. Then a day, and she watched the orb spider knit a message between two scuppernong vines. Then a month, and she took an axe, made a pile of split wood. One night she tucked her wild legs beneath her and unscrewed them at the hip. At home, her wife and son grew tired of magnolia cones thumping the roof and the air conditioning unit rattling the walls. After a year, they scanned the fresh-cut field for a rare sight of dolphins. The night was a closed box, and they dug out the recipe for peach pie. When the giant butterfly came clattering up the hall, her wife could only freeze and hope it passed by. Her son stretched out his arms to mimic the vast wingspan. They puffed out their cheeks and laughed, taking turns to bite the wooden spoon. At sunrise, the boy ran ashore for his other mother and hoped she would reappear in the water, the way sometimes the things we forget come back to us. Years passed, and from the woods, she watched lightning debunk the boundary fence. The outhouse door walloped in the wind, and storms tore up the yellow field. When she didn't return, her wife and son grew the peach trees higher and adjusted the recipe to reduce the nutmeg. In October, the stars set fire to the woodpile, and cicadas clicked so loudly the peach stones broke.
I think that's where we're going to end. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Hilary.
Thank you for listening to the Queer at Queen's podcast with Hilary McCollum and Don Watson. Catch us next time as Hilary interviews Paul Mattern.